Okay, good morning. I was hoping maybe more people will come today because today's session is really quite something that we don't learn very often. We'll see, maybe still people will come. The topic really is the question, what happened next? We finished the learning of Megillah last week and we got to the point where we sort of asked basic questions about the last chapter, but It's always something that bothered me over the years. I'm glad it wasn't just me. But I've got here a whole paper which I want to share with you, which highlights the question of what happened next. You come out of the Megillah reading, and it's like going to the theatre, right? So you've been to the theatre, you had an entertainment, you've seen the good guys and the bad guys, right? The curtain comes down at the end, you sing Shoshana Siakam, you go home. And you ask yourself the question, well, wait a minute, this story is not complete. What happened to Achashverosh? What happened to Mordechai? What happened to Esther? What happened to the Jews in Shushan? Did they go back to a normal life after that? What was going on? Right? And we don't usually follow up these questions because, you know, Purim is very self-contained. It's very enclosed. And we just don't sort of feel the need necessarily to take it further. But there is an interesting development. This is what I want to share with you today, which is the page I'm giving you here, again from Rav Ben Hillel, because he says that, look, the reality is that once you finish the Megillah and you go home and you don't think about the continuation, he says really you're missing something, right? You're missing really the essence, or more or less the purpose of the story. Is it just to go home and celebrate a holiday once a year? Or is it that there is a historical and religious significance to what happens once the story of the Megillah ends? And the question then is, what is that significance? Before we do that, I just mentioned before, and I want to mention again, one of the elements of the holiday. We know that we have four mitzvot of the day, right? We're supposed to read the Megillah twice. We have Sudat Purim, we have a special meal. Right, and we do gifts, we do mishloach manot, gifts to each other, chag ha-pashkas as I'm calling it, that's what it becomes. You know, you give candies to each other, which I don't know where that came from. I'm not sure if you're even yotze the mitzvah giving candies, but we all do. And then finally, there is this concept of matanot levyonim, gifts to the poor. Right, these are the basic mitzvot of Purim. And the question is, okay, I understand the suda, celebrating the miracle of we won, we survived. Right? And we drink and we're happy and all the rest of it. I understand reading the Megillah because that's reading the story of what happened. But what is this gifts to each other? What is that all about? And gifts to the poor. I mean, we have a mitzvot stocker every day. Right? We have this idea of helping each other every day. We have a mitzvot chesed every day. So what's happened on Purim, which becomes the focus of the day, and we all run around for a couple of hours, right? You know, and in some places you've got to be very careful when you drive around. This neighborhood, not too bad, but when you go in some neighborhoods, there's a lot of people driving around, delivering their parcels of food, right? You know, they pull up sharp. You've got to be very careful driving on Purim. It's a big problem. And what is that all about? Why has that become the focus? And essentially, this is what the men of Shushan, the people of Shushan, decided through Mordechai and Esther, particularly through Mordechai, that this was going to become the focus of the day. So we mentioned this, and Rav Rao says there are really two elements here. There's an element of celebrating the miracle, fine. But there's also an element of creating a community. He says what happened was, let's just open the door. The concept of celebrating the miracle and the concept of rejoicing on that is all well and good, but we do something else. We create community. I've mentioned this before. I was in Yerushalayim. I lived in Israel for 8 years. And one of the real pleasures of Purim was to drive around Me'er Sha'arim or that neighborhood, Geula. This is going back 35 years ago, but I'm sure it's still the same today. And what you would see from about 10 o'clock in the morning onwards would be people walking around, not with the baskets of candies that we seem to indulge in, but they're walking around with trays of food. And you read the halacha, it says that the idea of mishloach manot particularly is to make sure that everybody has food to celebrate the holiday. And in Me'er Sha'arim, I'm sure there are many families who cannot afford it. It's as simple as that. My granddaughter was doing chesed her year in Israel. She went to Me'er Sha'arim for one day to be with a family. There must have been 10 children living in maybe 3 rooms in a very small apartment. And she called home and she was crying. My daughter said, what happened? She said she opened up the refrigerator. There was no food in the fridge. There was nothing there. For 10 children in the house, they obviously did not have enough for literally to put bread on the table. And she wanted to know what she could do. And of course, you know, it's a complicated issue. And it's unfortunately the reality of life in so many families in that particular part of the world. So along comes Purim. And the rabbis really, on the basis of the story, and on the basis of what the people of Shushan experienced, decided that Purim has to have 2 focuses. Focus number 1, celebrate the miracle. Focus number 2, create a sense of community. One of the big issues of Purim, why it came about, why the problem came about, because the Jews were disconnected. They were, as we said, as we've suggested, that was assimilated community. And what happens in a period of assimilation is that you lose connection with the community. By definition, if you assimilate, you stop belonging to a shul, you stop belonging to Jewish organizations, you move away. And today, one of the big challenges, clearly, in American Jewry and around the world, is to reconnect those Jews. I saw a picture yesterday which really upset me of Jews standing side by side with Palestinians calling for destruction of the state of Israel. And this is a Jew standing there doing that. And you say, what? For goodness sake. How did you get so disconnected from the Jewish community and students? How did you get so disconnected that you want to see actively the destruction of Israel as the Palestinian voices seem to want to suggest at the moment? It's sad. And Purim is a time, and it's really one of those holidays in the year, when that esprit de corps, that sense of community is re-established, is recreated. And it's done very simply. We give each other food, and we make sure that the weaker elements of society have something to eat, have the money in which they would have, be able to go and celebrate the holiday. So matanot levyonim. So of course you've got a mitzvah stock on a Monday and a Tuesday and a Wednesday, but when it comes to Purim, there's an extra dimension. Because those two mitzvot, the mishloach manot, matanot levyonim, give the identity, the Jewish identity to so many people of the holiday. And the holiday, therefore, becomes a double celebration, a celebration of a salvation and a celebration of Jewish identity, meaning a community is recreated. And that's what Purim does. Purim is a wonderful holiday from that point of view to recreate, to re-establish the concept of community. And we all take it for granted and we live in wonderful communities wherever we are, in so many places around the world. And there is a reminder here, and it's so timely, I think, in as I said, in our day and age, where so many Jews are disconnecting from the community, it's one of those reminders that we need that really Purim is about community. And if we don't build and establish and maintain a good, strong Jewish community, then our lives are very much poorer for it, and in the end, we disappear. When Jewish communal infrastructure goes out of the window and Jews can't get together, then the community is in great danger. That community disappears. And of course, the Germans, Yimach Shemom, they understood that. They immediately stopped Jewish communal life. What was their focus? Stop Jews having organizations, stop them having religious organizations, stop everything. Throw them out of whatever you can. Because they understood that when a Jew becomes disconnected, seemingly they understood it, that you are no longer strong in numbers. You're by yourself. And when you're by yourself, you're not a community anymore. And this is what Purim is about. That's point number 1, and I said it before, and I think it's really, really significant. What we're going to do today, which is point number 2, is the question of what next? What happened next? And I'm going to read over this page that I gave you. I know it looks long, it's 3 pages, but it actually goes very quickly. And listen to this, because there's a book in the Bible, 2 books, which are rarely studied, the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah. Book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah cover a period in Jewish history when the Jews came out of the exile and returned to Israel. Somebody once put it very bluntly. He said, you ask many people, you'll take an opinion poll. What is the holiest place in the Jewish world today? The holiest place. So what will people say? Usually they would say, the Western Wall, the Kotel. And the answer is, that's wrong. That's place number two today. What's place number one? The Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount. That's our holiest place. The holy, the Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, where the mosque is. That is our place of holiness. The reality is, we can't go there. And you know, sometimes you say, you breathe a sigh of relief, because if they turned it into a tourist attraction, what it would become, I don't know. But on the other hand, it's wrong. If we want to go there and behave in a religious manner in that place, at this moment in time, we would be arrested by the Arab police that are in control over there. Israel gave them a free hand, don't ask me why. And as a consequence, we cannot go to our holiest place. And some groups of people do try to go up there on various holidays. Sometimes they get away with it, sometimes they have trouble. There was a Christian woman who was arrested up there about 6 months ago because she wanted to go there and say Psalms, right? In English. I think she came from Canada. And the Arab police thought that she was Jewish and she was davening. So immediately, two hefty guys lift her up and start taking her out. And she says, what are you doing? So they explained to her, they didn't explain to her, they said, this is forbidden, asur. And she said to them, I don't understand what you're saying, I'm here, I'm a Christian, and I want to pray in a holy place. And they took no prisoners, they basically, she was thrown out. And of course she complained, as they say in Yiddish, nothing came of it. It's really unbelievable. And this is what goes on. Our holiest place is the temple. Now, we're talking about the Purim story. Remember, we explained that this is a time in Jewish history when the Jews are outside Israel. Everyone agrees it's a story of the diaspora. And in the diaspora, what we saw was the dangers of, as we said, a community falling apart. And along come the heroes of the day, Mordechai and Esther, whichever way you understand them. We've explained a lot about, you know, what their background was. And we've said the heroes of the day brought the community together again. Matanos Evyonim, Mishloach Manot, etc., etc. Now we've got to understand there's got to be a further development. If this community is really going to survive as a Jewish community at a time when Israel, Jerusalem, is being abandoned because it's the exile, what is the future of such a community? When we don't have a place where we can focus, we focus our attention in prayer, but we don't actually have a place that we can say that this is where we go to. We go back to the 30s, and we lived through a time when Jews had nowhere to go. Nobody gave them an open door. The Americas certainly did not, and Britain very quickly shut the doors, and everybody stopped them going anywhere, and of course the consequence was that 6 million died. So the reality is, says Rabbi Lau, and he talks about this in the page that I gave you, that he says the Megillah and the story of the Megillah has got to continue to develop the diaspora community with a focus. And what's the focus? To look towards Israel. And this is exactly what happens, but it's not in the Megillah. It's in the book of Ezra, and mainly in the book of Nehemiah. So very quick information. Who were Ezra, and who was Ezra, who was Nehemiah? Ezra was a leader of the Jewish community in the exile in Persia, or in Babylon, I think he was in Mesopotamia, wherever he was. And he was given permission to come back to Israel. And he became the high priest, or rather the Kohen. He became the leader of the community. Ezra was a Kohen. And Ezra was a very dynamic character, very dynamic character. And when he returned to Israel, he brought with him a lot of people. Reminds me of the story. Yeah, Shabbat Gazon. I saw a picture of him this week, Rabbi Riskin. Rabbi Riskin from Lincoln Square. He went on Aliyah in 1985, 86, and he was told the only way you can come to this place, which is going to be called Ephrat, is if you bring families with you. And I think at the time 90 families went with him from New York. It's an unbelievable story. And you go there today and there's literally thousands and thousands of Jews living in this place. And it's an incredible thing. And what it took was a bit of bravery. You know, Rabbi Riskin was at the top of his career in New York. And he said, I'm done, I'm leaving this, I'm moving to Israel. And boy, he created something over there with the help of a lot of other people, which has now become a phenomenal success. Go to Ephrat. It's a wonderful, beautiful place. Are we talking? Oh, somebody's come in. The story of Ezra is the biblical version of what I just told you. Ezra decided the future of the Jewish people is not going to be in Persia, and is not going to be in the diaspora. It's got to be in Eretz Israel. So what do? You take the bull by the horns, as they say. You go to Nefesh B'Nefesh, and you say, I want to go live in Israel. So what did Ezra do? He made Aliyah. And he took with him thousands of people. It says, literally, we'll read the page, how many people went with. And Ezra began the process of recreating the dynamics of a religious community in Israel. What was going on? We know, we read about it, we said that the year 538, remember the whole dynamic of what we said at the beginning, Cyrus allows the Jews, the Persian emperor allows the Jews to go back to Israel, and for the next 75, 80 years, the Jews don't go. And that's when the story of Purim takes place, right? So you get around the year 470 BCE, because you go down from 538, which is when Cyrus allowed the Jews to go back, and the story of Purim is concluded. And then you have the beginnings of the story of Ezra, and then followed by Nehemiah, who was also an interesting character. And both of these gentlemen created a revolution. They took the dynamism, the event of the salvation of the Jewish people in the diaspora, and used the energy to take Jews to Israel. And when they took Jews to Israel, it wasn't just for the purposes, as we would say, kind of, you know, to grow tomatoes and potatoes. What they were doing was recreating and essentially establishing a Jewish community that could rebuild the Second Temple. They knew that a new temple had to be rebuilt. The problem was, how do you go about it? How do you start the project? So Ezra began it, and Ezra did a lot of things which we today take for granted, right? He was the guy who instituted laning 3 times a week. Okay, according to what we do, we take out the Torah Monday, Thursday, Shabbat afternoon, etc. That's because of Ezra. Moshe is attributed with part of that, but it came through Ezra later on. So Ezra decided so many things that we do in our Jewish lives. He was a scribe, and presumably he wrote down some of the documents and stuff. You know, there's a lot of discussion what Ezra was doing. However, what he did not achieve yet without the help of somebody called Nehemiah was to go and rebuild the temple, and particularly the walls of Jerusalem. If you have a temple but Jerusalem walls are gone, you just can imagine it, then it's open. It's open sesame, and anyone can walk in, and you've got a very beautiful building which is unprotected by the walls of Jerusalem. There's no walls. So Nehemiah had a double project. His project was, I'm going to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and I'm going to rebuild the temple of Jerusalem. And in that sense, Nehemiah took what Ezra started, and he took it up a notch. Not just to bring Jews back to Israel, but to get them excited and committed to building the second temple and the walls of Yerushalayim. Yes. Correct. In fact, you read the numbers, and it really is quite unbelievable. The whole story was 40,000 Jews that came back. That was it. Very few. I would say it was minimal, because after the story of Gedaliah, when Gedaliah was assassinated, it says most of the Jews ran away to Egypt. So if there were Jews around, I mean, you're talking maybe a few hundred, maybe 1,000. Sorry? Very, very small, insignificant number. 70 years, the land, it says, was fallow. In other words, you know, they brought them back. And what is so unbelievable is the way they did it. Because nowadays, there is a big issue. Jews have come back, particularly from the Soviet Union. And there's been a lot of issues that one partner is Jewish, one partner is not Jewish. And how did the rabbinate deal with it? Very badly. You know, they started making a whole series of ways to deal with the problem, and it's created a lot of bad feeling, particularly amongst the Ethiopians, whose Jewishness was always important to them and has been questioned by the rabbinate. The bottom line with Ezra was that he said it very simply. If your wife's not Jewish, you leave her behind. You come back to Israel, you leave the family, the non-Jewish family behind, because she wasn't Jewish, and basically you're divorced or whatever, you won't really marry, come back to Israel on your own. And people did it. What is incredible is people heard it. And when you read what Ezra and Nehemiah did in terms of Jewish law, it is staggering. Staggering. They made a law of Muktzah on Shabbat, not to move things on Shabbat. people were overwhelmed by this, because what happened was he saw that the laws of Shabbat were not being observed. This started really more with Nehemiah. It's in the book of Nehemiah, he talks about it. And he says, what did I do? Instead of making the laws of Shabbat easier, I made them tougher. So I made the law of Muktzah. So not only now can you not take money, but you can't even move it. Not only now can you not do business, but you can't do anything to do with business, right? And all of the laws of Muktzah kicked in. And the people were, let's put it this way, the people accepted it. They didn't rebel. It's an amazing story. But what I want to talk about particularly with Nehemiah was, again, the parallel between Nehemiah and Mordechai. Nehemiah was a man who was in the palace of the Persian emperor. He was the head butler. He used to, like in the story with Joseph and the butler and the baker, right? He was the head butler. And what did Nehemiah do? He used to pour the wine for the king. So one day, he goes to the king, and he is crying his eyes out. If you look at the page, I'll show you exactly where it is. And it is quite extraordinary. The story of Nehemiah, it's on page 2. It's on page 2. And it's the column on the right-hand side. Aliyat Nehemiah Kehemshech LeMegillat Esther. Right, I'll show you what's going on here. And it's the paragraph which is in heavy black print on the right-hand side on page 2. Listen to this. Divrei Nehemiah ben Hakalia. This is the words of Nehemiah. Vayhi b'chodesh Kislev, the month of Kislev, Shnat Esrim, in the 20th year, presumably of the reign of the king of Persia, which in fact at this point we know was Darius, the son of Esther, who stayed with Achashverosh, and they had a son. That's pretty shocking news. And it was Shanat Esrim Vani Ayiti B'Shushan Abira. And in fact, Nehemiah says, I was in Shushan. Here we go. After Purim. The whole story. And he says, Vayovo Chanani Echad Me'achai. One of my brothers came from Israel to Persia. Probably took a few weeks. Hu V'Anashim Yehuda came from Judea. And I asked him about the Jews that were living in Jerusalem. What was the situation? As you say, what's up? What's the matzah? What's happening in Jerusalem? Whoever is living in Jerusalem at this point is living in terrible, terrible circumstance. They are being despised by the people around them. They tried for nearly 100 years to build the temple. Every time they tried to build it, they were stopped. There were people called Shomranim, and there were other groups who all wrote letters to the emperor, whoever was in charge of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was distant from Persia. But whoever was in charge, they wrote letters saying the Jews are planning to rebel, don't let them build the temple. And it was stopped. The project stopped, start the whole time. For 100 years, almost 100 years, was put on hold. And he says, V'chomad Yerushalayim Mefaretzet, U'sha'areh Nitetzu Ba'esh. The gates of Jerusalem were burnt down. They're singed. Go to Jerusalem today, there's a relic. It's called the Beit HaSaruv. You see a stone relic of those days. A house with stones which are singed. And this is exactly what Ezra said happened. They couldn't burn the stone, but they certainly singed it. They certainly give it a singe, which is there. You can see, you know, these things you can see today. It's amazing. Look what Rabbi Lau says. Nehemiah, the next paragraph. Nehemiah memaleh tafkid Esther Mordechai gam yachad. Nehemiah is Esther Mordechai rolled into one. Hu mesharet et hamelech v'nechshav karov lemalchut. He's very close to the king. It's like Mordechai all over again. Od Yehudi, another Jew, she'etzliach la'alot l'gedula, he becomes great, ma'arechet ha'shilton ha'parsit, in the Persian Empire. Nehemiah rises to the top. Hu chai et chaye achotze b'toch achrayut, u'mesirut, he's very loyal to the king, v'she'elat eretz Yisraeliyah einom pogat. And initially, he doesn't think about Israel at all. He's made it. He is dreaming the Persian dream. Last section on the right-hand side. Ad sheba ha-palit levakro. Then this guy comes from a mishulach, comes in, he's from Eretz Yisrael, he only speaks Hebrew, and he has this conversation. Habikur hazeh noga upaga l'Nechemya b'makom rikshi, and Nechemya starts crying. It hits him emotionally. And Nehemiah says, I can't stand this anymore. I can't be satisfied being in the exile, in the diaspora, when my brothers in Israel, the few people that were brave enough to go, are suffering in such a terrible way. In 1700s, they started, when the Jews started making aliyah from Lithuania, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, and later on, around the same time, the Talmidim of the Besht, of the Baal Shem Tov, they went to Eretz Yisrael. It was very difficult. There was plague, sanitary conditions were zero, there was always something going on. And they made what they called the Magbit. They started collecting money, the Kolel Rab Meir Balanes, which is still around to this very day. They have a big soup kitchen in Yerushalayim. All of this came out of Jews looking towards Israel and saying, if we're not going to be there, let's at least help our brethren who are living there, who are struggling not to make money there, but to survive from day to day. And look what it says, the bottom two lines on the right-hand side. Vayihi kishomiyat advarim o'ele, yashavti ve'evkeh. Nehemiah says, I sat and I cried. And ve'et abla yamim, I mourned for days. Vayihi tzam, I fasted, umitpalel, and I davened, lifnei olehei shamayim. Before the God of heaven. And look at the middle section where it says Nehemiah chapter 2. Because what did Nehemiah do as a reaction? He went to the king. He went to Darius. And he said to the king, I need a favor from the king. And he knew that the king might turn around and really take it very badly. He said, My whole ancestry in Jerusalem is in danger. Nothing is happening the way it should. The second temple is not being rebuilt. The walls of Jerusalem are still smashed to smithereens. He said to the king, I want to go back and I want to help my brethren in Jerusalem. This is all after the Megillah. Listen to this because it's so beautiful. And it's the middle section, again in the heavy black print. Vayihi b'chodesh Nisan. Just read, because this is the book of Nehemiah, which I'm assuming many people never ever get to. It's like the end of the Bible. And look how interesting it is. Vayihi b'chodesh Nisan. Month of Nisan, Shnat Esrim la'atashasta Melech Hamelech, and this is Artaxerxes. So this is a bit earlier, before Darius. This is the one before Darius. Somebody called Artaxerxes. What happened? And Yain lefanav. He did his thing with the wine. Ve'esata Yain v'dna laMelech v'la'iti ra lefanav. And usually I was in good spirits. When I went to the king, I never put on a sour face because the king would notice. But Vayomali HaMelech, after he had the news from Eretz Israel, he was sad. So what did the king do? Vayomali HaMelech, Madua Panecha Raim, why are you looking so upset? The king noticed that Nehemiah was sad. Vata Incha Chole, you're not sick. Ein Ze Ki Im Roa Leiv, it's because you're harboring something in your heart. So of course, Nehemiah got worried that the king suspects that he was going to do a rebellion. Va'iraha be'ma'on. So Nehemiah said, I was very afraid. I thought the king was going to kill me. Va'amar la'melech. And I made my pitch, says Nehemiah. Ha'melech la'olam yichyeh. May the king live forever. This is King Artaxerxes. Madua lo yeru panai asher ha'ir beit kivrot avotai chareva u'sha'are u'chlu ba'esh. Of course I'm sad. Because I just got news that my whole ancestry in Jerusalem is still completely destroyed. Vayomali HaMelech, and the king said, Al ma ze'ata mevakesh. What do you want? Ve'et palel Elohei Shemayim. At that point, I daven, because I'm going to ask for something that I'm not sure he'll grant my wish. Va'omar LaMelech, verse 5, Posuk Hey. So I said to the king, Im al HaMelech Tov, if it's good, V'im yitav avtecha lefanecha. This is the language of the story of the Megillah, the same language. Im al ha-melech tov, if it's good for you. And if you agree, asher tishlocheni el Yehuda el ir kivrot avotai ve'evnena. I want to go back to Jerusalem, I want to rebuild it. That was Nehemiah's request to the king. V'ayom ali ha-melech v'ashegal yoshevet etzlo. The king is sitting there with his concubine or whatever it was. Some say this was actually Queen Esther, but it doesn't say clearly. Ad matai yiyeh mahalachecha. How long are you going to be away? Matai tashuv, when are you coming back? Vayitav lifnei amela, and the king agreed. Vishlacheni vedna lo zaman. I gave him a time frame. Yeah, it's so interesting. Sorry, again?
Who was the king who conquered the Jews?
Brought them was King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And he was taken over by the Persians. So now we're talking about the Persian Empire. Absolutely. This is about probably 300 or 400 years before the Romans. Right? It's a long time. We've still got to do the Greeks. We've got Alexander the Great. We've got the whole Hanukkah story still to come. So this is very, very early days. Around the year 450. They estimate 450, which is, if you say Alexander the Great was around the year 300, so it's 150 years before Alexander the Great. Correct. That's a bit later on. Much later. Much later. Okay. Now, the question is that Nehemiah was taking a chance. He wants to go back to Yerushalayim, and he didn't know whether the king would agree. And the king said yes. And look at the final verse there, verse 7. V'amar l'melech emal ha'melech tov. All the language of the Megillah is coming out here. Nehemiah is like Mordechai and Esther going to the king, asking for the king to save the Jews. In this case, Nehemiah is going to the king, asking for the king to give permission for Nehemiah to go back to Eretz Israel to rebuild the Jewish community. Particularly, not just the community, but to build the temple and the walls of Jerusalem. And it says, there's only one problem, it's a dangerous trip. I'm going from Persia all the way west to Israel. I need some sort of letter from the king to protect me. When everybody stops me on the way and they check my my ID, I need a letter from you. So he says, give me letters. Al pachvot eva'ana, to all those officers on the other side of the river, presumably the Euphrates or wherever. Asher yaviruni, they'll take me across. Ad asher avol Yehuda, to get me to Yehuda, bring me to Israel. And the king said yes. Look at column number 3. And what happened when he arrived in Jerusalem? Column number 3, again, the heavy print. And I'm just basically saying over a lot of the commentary of what Rabbi Lau says, but we're reading the book of Nehemiah. That's what we're doing. But what an incredible guy this guy must have been. Look at section, column 3. V'avol Yerushalayim, I came to Jerusalem. V'hi sham yamim shlosha, I was there for 3 days. V'akum laila aniv anashim ma'ati mi, I got up at night time. This may be the source of what we call Tikkun Chatzot. When Jews get together, the Kotel, they get up at midnight. There's a whole group of them. And there's a special tefillah, which they say every night to mourn the destruction of the temple. And he did this in his time, Nehemiah. I didn't tell anybody what God was inspiring me to do in Jerusalem. I didn't even have an animal with me. I had nothing, in other words, no means of support. I just came on my donkey and that was it. And he says, Eitzah b'Shar HaGai. We know Shar HaGai is on the way up to Jerusalem. Laila, I went out through Shar HaGai. El Pnei Ein Tanin, another name of a place. El Shar Shpot. And I got eventually to the gate of Ashpot, which is the gate that we go in by the Kotel. That's the Jerusalem gate. Vehi shover b'chomot Yerushalayim, and he said, I saw the walls of Jerusalem were broken, ashehein prutzim u'sharei uchlu ba'esh, and I saw that everything was still completely burnt in fire. So Nehemiah looks around and he sees that there is, without doubt, a massive, massive problem. And what happens after, I'm just going to read the paragraph, the last paragraph on the left-hand side. Nehemiah wrote Yerushalayim b'shifluta. He saw Jerusalem at a point which we can't imagine. Go to Jerusalem today and imagine that all you've got there is a few bits of rubble and nothing. No, you know, there's no Ramot, there's no Iratika, there's nothing there. It et chomad Yerushalayim ashvura. All you can see is the broken walls, v'tasharim asrufim, and the burnt gates. The Jaffa gate completely burned down. Kavah avru kimat mea shana. And this is 100 years. Me'az atzarat Koresh, after Cyrus said to the Jews, go home. What had been done in 100 years? Kimat, absolute, almost nothing. Yushalayim adayin avela. Jerusalem was still mourning. Chorva v'shomima. It was in a state of destruction. Unechlatz latchilat binyan Yushalayim. So Yechemiah said, I've got to start the project. Not that I'm starting it because they tried and it was stopped. I've got to complete it. Ubekach mushutav mangatoshal Ezra, and he had Ezra was already there. So the two of them teamed up, and this was a very strong team. Movilat am Yisrael tkuva bayit sheni. They bring the Jews to the point where the second temple can be rebuilt. Turn over to page 3 because these comments that he makes now are absolutely fantastic. Kach niftachat hatkufa chadasha shel am Yehudi. Habonet beito be'eretz Yisrael. This is the real conclusion of the Megillah. By the time the whole story of the saving of the diaspora community in Persia is complete, what comes next? You know what comes next? Going back to Eretz Yisrael. They are saved. Now again, there's so much discussion with the non-coincidence. There's no coincidence. But when how can one understand the events of the Holocaust followed by the establishment of the State of Israel? And there's no question that obviously one sees a parallel, not necessarily to compare in terms of the events, because the Holocaust represents the greatest tragedy for the Jewish people ever. But you do see this kind of concept that at the end, when we're still around and we're still existing, even though the great attempt was made to destroy every Jew in the world, God forbid, and it nearly got there. If he succeeded, you know, we wouldn't be sitting here today. But the reality is that that was followed by the most fantastic focus of the Jewish people to return to Eretz Israel. And Rav Lau wants to suggest that this is a paradigm established from the story of Purim. There is a follow-up. The follow-up to the story of Purim is when? In the book of Nehemiah. It's when Nehemiah becomes the catalyst for the return of the Jews to Eretz Israel. And it's fabulous. Look what he says, second line. Omnom, ein kan atzmaut medinit. At the moment, they're still not independent, right? The big difference between today and Nehemiah's days, that in Nehemiah's days, they were still bound to the Empire of Persia. Today, we are an independent state, right? We're not bound to anybody, not even to the Americans anymore. You know, in fact, we probably do more for America. They're just trying to work out an antidote. They're working in Israel on a drug to send out because of this virus that's going around. It's really staggering that of all the countries they're talking about that will get the medicine, Israel will be maybe one of the first to do it. Right? And you say, how can that be? You've got countries which are so developed and have such a history of research. And along comes a country 70 years old. Right? And the original people that went there were so tzebrochen, they were so broken from their experience. And here's a country that's going to change the world. It's already changing the world. We've all got a cell phone. Most of that technology comes from Israel. My wife's relative spent 2 years in Kansas City, from boy. He came here because he was developing voicemail. We all take voicemail for granted. But he came around about the year 2003, 2004, and he was in Kansas on behalf of Sprint. Sprint Israel sent him to Sprint Kansas to develop voicemail. An Israeli technician coming to America to develop something which we now take for granted. If we can't leave a message on our cell phone, oy vavoy, we're in trouble. And all of that technology came from Israel. We take it for granted, but it's all really intense technology. And, you know, go ask the BDS this famous question. If you want to divest from Israel, you're never going to walk in a hospital. Because most of the technology that might save your life in a crisis, that you have a heart attack, God forbid, is going to be made in Israel, a lot of those machines. And, you know, and go on and on and on, your cell phone and all the other dozens, if not hundreds of things that Israel has sent from the technology that's been developed around the world. You want to divest from Israel, go and live in a cave, because that's basically where you've got to go and live. And that's why this whole thing is just so not depressing, it's actually so upsetting. And Jews are getting sucked into this propaganda against Israel. Israel's not perfect. There's no question about that. But boy, oh boy, that Jews should be anti-Israel in the way that they are presenting themselves, that I cry. I mean, I'm crying like Edna and Nehemiah. I'm looking at the Jewish community in the diaspora, and it makes you want to cry. That Jews can be so distant and disconnected. This week they had APAC. So thank God APAC is a wonderful moment, even if it's all very glitzy and very, you know, put together in a certain way. But it is an enormous number of Jews, 18,000, right, go to APAC, all on behalf of the state of Israel. And my son-in-law went from to Washington this week, and he said the incredible thing for him was the bipartisan. You had Republicans and Democrats and Independents. Everybody was there supporting, giving speeches on behalf of Israel. He said that was really what made it for him. Incredible. APEC, it's the conference, what do they call it, American-Israel IPAC. Yeah, and it was happening in Washington this week. Incredible event. And again, that is so encouraging. And they... It's incredible. Can't explain. And it's and this is what the follow-up to Purim is. This is why I think this is so beautiful, that we see the seeds of what we are living today in the follow-up to the Purim story. And again, I would challenge you whether you've ever heard this before, because I certainly have not heard this till it was explained to me. I never come across this. I'm just going to finish these paragraphs. There's two more columns, and I want to go through it because it's so beautiful. He says the second line at the end of the line on the right-hand side, what's happening in the day of Nehemiah is restoring the crown to its former glory. Yerushalayim shelifnei Nehemiah hi'ir reka mitoshavim. Jerusalem, before Nehemiah comes along, is barren, empty. Very few people living there. They're not even living in houses. They're living in hovels. Who knows what they're living in? And long comes Nehemiah, when he builds the walls of Jerusalem, he becomes alive, the city. Atirat shvakim. It grows. Marketplaces and commerce and everything else that's going on, all happening in Jerusalem because of Nehemiah and Ezra. He says, Zem alach asiyum shel Megillah. This is what the end of the story of the Megillah is really about. Ha'am mo'es begalut, the people reject the diaspora in the sense that this is not the be-all of Jewish existence anymore. Va'oleh or Olah livnot et Eretz Yisrael, they go back to build Israel. And that is the real end of the story. And I just want to read you section D about the walls. He says, Achomash or Nehemiah b'chnisato Yushalayim mefuretzet. The wall that Nehemiah sees when he gets there is broken. Zeb bitui lechurban. Obviously a metaphor for the whole destruction. Ruvdan ribonut, and the loss of independence, autonomy. They're not in control of their own lives. Ulam Nehemiah b'koach emunah b'tachon shabo, he was such a man of faith, Nehemiah, bokea b'toch chomat Yerushalayim, over bein mapolot avanim, he walks amongst the piles of stones, v'choteh l'taken et ha'ir chareva, and he starts a plan to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Hu lo baz liyom katnut v'lo nita mikol k'shayim politim. He doesn't back away, even if there's a lot of political issues going on against him, habitchoniim or matters of security, vechevratiim or matters of society, shagom lanshe aliyah rishon, arishona lifron yadan, to stop the people doing it the first time round. When they came back after Cyrus, they couldn't do the project; they were stopped. Nehemiah hofech liyot hamashakem agadol shel chevra yudit beretz Yisrael. Nehemiah is the equivalent of the early Zionists who came to claim the land of Israel in the 20th century. And Nehemiah did it so many thousands of years ago. And he goes on, again, this is beautiful. He says, Bala Masara Marameza Yachsola Nehemiah Ali Deka. What is the relationship to Nehemiah? He says, Shepotach et hamem astuma. It's a whole discussion about the way that the word mem is written. In the book of Nehemiah, it's written, should be written as a regular mem, this word that we just read before. Hashehem Purutzim talks about the walls being broken. Hey Mem, the Mem should be written as it were. He says it's written with a square Mem. The idea is that this again is a symbol, he says, of Jerusalem becoming more established, the final Mem, as opposed to a regular Mem. I'm not going to go into that. That's a whole Gemara about that. The use of the lettering in the book of Nehemiah. I'm going to go to the last column because listen to this. This is fabulous. Nehemiah announces a whole new period of Jewish history. Amnam ein betekufa zo neviim. There's no more prophets. The prophets are gone. Vanaga overed el chachamim yotzrei Torah shebal peh. And who takes over? The rabbis. Is that a good thing? In those days, it seems to have been a good thing. Nowadays, one has questions, but there's no question about it. That's what happened. Ezra sofer, Ezra the scribe, you say that Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the great assembly, got them all together, 120 rabbis. Just as Nehemiah measured the walls of Jerusalem, kach yimdod Ezra kol otcha b'Torah. Ezra measured every letter in the Torah. V'yidrosh v'yitaken, and he gave the authentic version of Torah, he put it right. Over the years, they've crept in maybe some errors, and he went through it literally with a fine-tooth comb. Yigzov yichadesh yamid et Torah tila be'ir mechudeshet. Kimu v'kiblu says at the end of the Megillah, they re-established their connection to the Torah. They received the Torah again. That means that after Purim ended, along comes Ezra, and he looks at the scrolls of Torah and puts it all in order, and very much orders it to the point where we have eventually what we know as the Bible. And all of that is down to Ezra. So on the one hand, you've got Ezra doing the religious stuff, and you've got Nehemiah, who is, you know, a builder. He's a Kablan. He's a person who's developing the building side of Jerusalem. Look at the final paragraph. This is amazing. They had to celebrate when the walls of Jerusalem were finished. Because it wasn't just finishing the temple, but it was finishing the walls, which meant that the temple would now be protected, as it was for over 400 years. Till the Romans came and they had an amazingly difficult time destroying it. Right? They had 4 years of a siege just to get into Jerusalem. So, go figure, this was a tremendous building project which Nehemiah completed. So look at section E, and this is, I always argue, there's always something worth coming out to here, and this is it. He says like this, Yom b'niyat chomat Nehemiah. What day did they establish as a holiday? If you're going to celebrate the finishing of the project, as Nehemiah wanted to celebrate, what date did he choose? Tet Zayin Badar, go figure, the 16th of Adar. Hemshech l'chag ha-Purim. So in Jerusalem, what would they do? They'd have the 14th of Adar for the people outside Jerusalem, Purim. They'd have the 15th of Adar for the people in Jerusalem, celebrating Purim, a diaspora holiday. And then the 16th of Adar, the whole Olam would come to Jerusalem, those who weren't there, and they would have the celebration on the completion of the walls of Jerusalem. That must have been a 3-day wow. Unbelievable. Because this is the final, this is the real focus of the continuation of the Purim story, the completion of the Jewish homeland, receiving Jews back into Eretz Israel, literally now for hundreds of years. Look at this final paragraph. It's precious. He says, "B'sefer Megillat Ta'anit." There's a whole section of Talmud which is called Megillat Ta'anit. He says, "Nimsa lanu." It's recorded in that we have the book you have in the library here. Shatarich shebo humdam chomot Yerushalayim ulai zusha Nehemiah hayatet zayin badar. When were the walls finally established of Jerusalem? On the 16th of Adar. And he gives the quote, which is in the two lines that you have. I'll just read the line, which is in brackets. B'shishasa lechodesh Adar heitira libnot et chomot Yerushalayim. They completed to build the walls of Jerusalem. On the 16th of Adar. Listen to this. The final 10 lines. Megillat Ta'anit Meshameret Avurenu Mikbatz Tarichim. This whole section of traditional, what is called Megillat Ta'anit, this whole section, preserves many, many days, special days. Shebehem Nasa Yomim Tovim Nisro. Most of them we don't keep. But these were holidays that they used to keep. Hakashurim Elamidah Lu'umit Yisraelit, which to do with the Jewish community, and particularly in Israel, and celebrating these days. Zeh Sefer Karutz Mechumarim Shemanigut Hamamina Bekesha. What does the book represent? People who believed in the link Shebein Am LaArtzo, between the people and its land, Umoeset Begola, and they rejected the diaspora. The Jew really can only survive in Eretz Israel properly. And that's something that Nehemiah knew, and he wanted to bring it about for the future. And that was, as we're saying, the consequence of the Purim story. The Purim story told the Jews one thing, that if you think you can survive easily in the diaspora without any problems, forget about it. They'll come along an Achashverosh and a Haman, and you're in big trouble. And there comes along a Hitler, and you're in big trouble all over again. And I don't understand. I wasn't there, and I can't comment on why they said it, but so many religious leaders said Hitler will go away, everything will be fine. Don't go to Israel, that's treif. Don't go to America, it's even more treif. Stay in Poland and everything will be fine. And look what happened, Nebuch. And I don't get it. I just don't understand that. Some leaders were very, very realistic and saw that the Jews had to get out. But so many just said it'll all go away like it always did. On that occasion it didn't. And how sad. Look at the consequence. It's frightening. So he says, look at this last five lines. Purim Shel Megillat Esther Nikvar Yudalet Tetvav Adar. We know that the whole story of Purim is celebrated the 14th and 15th of Adar. Keneged Ha'amida Yudit Al Mishma Chayim, when the Jews stood for their lives. Keneged Ha'kamim Lorogam, against those who tried to kill them. La'acha Purim Zeh, after this regular Purim that we're coming up to, Matu'ad Yom Tetzayim Ba'Adar, the 16th of Adar became a holiday. Now we have Yom Yerushalayim because of 1967. We do it in the end of Iyar. But according to this, there should really be a kind of Yom Yerushalayim the day after Purim is finished. Shushan Purim, Purim, Shushan Purim, and then Yom Yerushalayim. That's what it should be according to the ancient calendar. Because that was the day when they celebrated the completion of the building of the walls of Jerusalem, protecting the Jews in Yerushalayim. Ki Yom Chagosh HaNechemiah, which was the holiday of Nehemiah. Petichat HaChomah, opening of the walls, meaning access to come in and out. Vereshit Tekufat HaTorah Shebalpeh, and it began the whole period of what we know as the oral law. The Talmud, the Mishnah, followed by the Talmud, followed by Midrash, and everything else that came, all started at that time. And he says, Zui Alternativa Tzionit L'Chag HaPurim. He says that this is the Zionist alternative, meaning the other story of the story of Purim. Purim is a celebration of the diaspora for sure. But the continuation, what happened next, is a celebration of the Jews returning to Eretz Israel. And it took a long time. It doesn't happen overnight. Everybody is saying, you know, what took so long when the Jews started moving back? The original Yishuv started in the middle 1800s. Right? You read about this. The original Jews that went to settle some of the early places, the Chovei Tzion, they were religious people. Shmuel Moliver, the very famous rabbis who supported them, went. And it took a long time to get going. Till you come to Theodor Herzl in 1896 and the Zionist Congresses. And eventually, 1910, 1920, the Aliyah began. And Jews started coming till the British closed the doors to their eternal shame. And everything else happened. Then you get to 1948. The reality is, we can see from the original effort of Nehemiah, it takes 100 years. It took him 100 years. From the end of the Purim story, rather from the beginning of the Purim story, when Koresh, Cyrus, gives the permission for the Jews to go back, till the moment when Ezra and Nehemiah can celebrate, we're back, we're here, we're building the walls, we built the temple, we're here to stay, that took 100 years, nearly 100 years. So we understand, we have to understand that this is something which doesn't happen overnight. But look how powerful this conclusion is. Just read the conclusion on the side and we're done for today. The book of Nehemiah's conclusion of Megillat Esther. Building of the walls is completed, a new Chag is proclaimed, the repair in the connection to Eretz Israel is now in place. And he says what happened from Sefer Nehemiah chapter 8, Manot le'ein nachon lo. They sent gifts to each other. On that 16th of Adar, they celebrated with a combined Mishloach Manot and Matanot Levyonim. Ezra understood and Nehemiah understood, if we're going to survive in Eretz Israel, it's not just about having religious buildings, but it's about community. And they started building community by encouraging Jews to support each other. Bring the food to each other, bring the gifts, help people. And that's the lesson of Purim, as it says at the bottom, Kihila Chesed. And boy, this is beautiful. Yeah. Yeah.
So I understand that Darius was very obvious.
Yeah.
But I don't understand, it seems like she stayed with him, now she's not permitted to Mordecai.
Yeah.
Now she'll not be very important.
Correct. And this is all going to be discussed next week. Next week's lesson, please God, will be the famous question that is the elephant in the room, is you go to Persia, the Iranians want to try and break it up. They want to destroy it. But it's got, I don't know, it's protected by their laws, whatever the laws they have. But next week, Bezrat Hashem, I've saved it for after Purim. I don't want to spoil your holiday completely. And after Purim, we're going to talk a bit about what was the ramification of Esther's relationship with Ahasuerus. And how do we ever explain any rationale for what she did by staying with Ahasuerus? We know they stayed together and they had a child together. So if and particularly according to Rabbi Meir, as we explained, she was married to Mordechai, right? Most people say she wasn't, but if you say she was, that even makes it more incredible. What is going on? We're going to come across a concept which is something that you probably never heard of. Right? It's a Talmudic concept which is only used in very extreme situations, called Avera Lishma. Doing a sin for the sake of God. Think about that. Okay? That doesn't mean I go home and have my cheeseburger and say I'm doing it for the sake of God. Sorry? Yeah, but that's the question. Did she go willingly? Did she not go willingly? It's complicated. And we're going to see by the time we get to the end of the Megillah story, something where the rabbis are, I'm going to argue, very uncomfortable with Esther. And that's why I explained that Esther goes to the rabbis and says, write it all down. Immediate reaction was, no. So most people explain because they didn't want to create anti-Semitism. But you know what? It could have been that they just did not see Esther as the role model which they wanted to relate to. You know why? Because she stays with the king. She doesn't go back to Mordechai. She doesn't put on a tichel and go back to Meir Shearim. She doesn't do that. Or wherever. Sorry? Correct. There's a lot of complications. So it could be that there's a suggestion that maybe there was a divorce going on here. There's a lot of stuff which we need to explain. I mean, even if she doesn't go back to Mordechai, but how can you stay with the king? So if you say she stayed with the king because she had no choice, all right. What else could she do? But there's more to say than that. So that's next week's lesson, please God. All right, just got to drum up a few more people and hopefully we'll have a decent turnout. Yes, please. Yes, the walls around the old city. Each section, and you need, when you go to Israel, get a guide to show you. Each section of the wall, as you go from ground to ceiling, as they say, each section it represents a different period in world history. And the last section at the top is from the Muslims in the 1600s, Salah ad-Din and that whole story. But you go further down, and you know at the Kotel, you can look down into the bottom there, those big stones at the bottom. Those come from these days, from the days of Ezra, maybe even earlier than that. But the suggestion is that that is the wall, the original wall that was built by Ezra. The whole level of Jerusalem was a bit lower. And the original wall, when you look down, those enormous stones and how they moved them, God only knows. And all that stuff. And built on the same lines, yeah. And I presume where the walls were destroyed, that became the building line. So that they could see where to build and where to start rebuilding the walls. But what I think is so beautiful here is the understanding of what came next. The focus on Eretz Yisrael. You can make a whole, literally, you can make a beautiful drosh out of this. You can make an appeal out of this, right? You can go and say to the people, now, what do you do after Purim? You just let it blow over another year? Or do you get excited about it? And what, of course, did the rabbis say? But Nisan Nigalu, Nisan becomes a month of redemption. Not by accident. Because the focus, maybe, the rabbis understood, the next stage of Purim's got to be Geula. It's got to be redemption. That's the next month. Right? And they say Purim and Pesach got to come together. I had a student. I want to tell you this great story because Hasidim are famous for this. They're not really good at keeping dates, particularly Goisha dates, as they call it. So we had a student in school. So we asked the parents. We interviewed the parents. He was a Rebbe somewhere in White Lake, up in the mountain. So we said, your daughter's coming into the school. When was she born? So he looked, he's smart. He says, between Purim and Pesach. I said, between Purim and Pesach? What does that mean? You know, was she born on a Monday, Tuesday? What? He didn't know. As far as he was concerned, the date was between Purim and Pesach. It's like a Jewish thing. You don't even have the dates in your mind, but to me, it's what we're saying now. Purim followed by Pesach. Redemption in the diaspora followed by, please God, Geula to Eretz Israel. Isn't that's something to take away? It's beautiful. I'm very excited about this show. I gave it at YU a number of years ago. It's a beautiful, to me, it's really exciting. Something that I hope you'll share, please God. And next week, as I said, we're talking about the controversial stuff. Yes. He fixed it. For instance, he created the whole thing of the writing. You know, the Torah is written in a special writing called Ketav Ashurit, Assyrian Hebrew. That came from Ezra, apparently, as far as I understand. He formalized it. Doesn't mean that it wasn't like that before, but he went through it literally line by line. And a lot of people say, when we get Kri Ketiv, that means we have a word which is written and we read it differently, which we have a number of examples in the Torah, that's because of Ezra. What Ezra did is that he preserved the way it was written, but he said we've got to read it in a different way. And in the Tochacha, there are a number of words which are written one way. We read it completely differently. We actually don't read the word which is written in the Torah. So the rabbis say, who had the authority to do that? Ezra. He was a massive authority in his day. The answer is it is, but there were certain traditions which had developed maybe from the years and years of exile when things became a bit cloudy. Yeah, in the end, when the Jews went out of Israel, were they able to take all their scrolls with them? What Torah scrolls did they have left? Look at the history of the first temple. They burnt most of the Torah scrolls. They didn't have them. So when Ezra comes along and he wants to establish the books of Torah, he's got a big problem. Where's my copy? Where do I copy it from? Not saying there was none, but there's very few. And you look in the end of the book of Kings, you'll see that's what was going on. And any books of Torah they had, because of the idolatry, they cut out the word of God. So very often you wouldn't have the Shem Hashem in the Torah scroll. There would be a gap. So all of these apostle Torahs had to be done something with. I presume Ezra took them all together and he began a project of producing, nowadays they would call it the art scroll version. It was the Ezra version, right? And he produced that version which became accepted. This maybe is a miracle in itself by everybody. And that's the story of Ezra. So my encouragement to you is to take the book of Ezra, book of Nehemiah, give it a read. It's really, really overwhelming. It's quite extraordinary. Thank you, everybody. Have a good day. Thank you. And have a good Purim. Really, everybody should enjoy.